Okay, well, I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to come here and also just to give this talk. So what I'm going to talk about is strongly correlated electrons in one particular class of layered organic superconductors. These are quasi-two-dimensional, and one thing I'm going to try and emphasize is that this is one distinct class. And I think that there's significant opportunities for dynamical mean field theory here, particularly coupling it with realistic band structure calculations. Now, most of this work I'm going to talk about was done a while ago, and some of you have actually heard various renditions of this talk earlier, so I feel a little bad about talking about some of this older stuff, and it's not because of that I haven't been doing anything since then, particularly because we've been doing a lot of stuff on some of the other organics, but the reason I wanted to talk about this at least first was because particularly some of the people aren't aware of this work, and because it does couple in so strongly with the theme of the workshop. So, and I should say that almost all of this work was done with Jaime Marino when he was a postdoc with me in Sydney and then in Brisbane, and now he's in Stuttgart. So these are the main points that I want to convince you of. First of all, just looking at experimental data, I want to convince you that this particular class of organics, and I'll explain what it is a strongly correlated metal close to a Mott insulating phase. And particularly, you see a clear crossover from a Fermi liquid to a bad metal at temperature scales of about 30 Kelvin. Now, the relevant theoretical model for this, at least the simplest model, is a Hubbard model on an anisotropic triangle lattice, and it's at half filling. Now, one thing we found was that this coherence temperature is nicely described by dynamical mean field theory. Now, a bit more controversial is the idea that is that the superconductivity here is mediated by spin fluctuations and has dx squared minus y squared symmetry. And I'll talk at the end about particularly open questions and particularly where dynamical mean field theory comes into play. So, and feel free to ask questions. So now let me just put this all in context. Okay, now not all organic superconductors are the same. There's a whole diverse range. Some people would say there's a whole zoology of them. But we've got the Bechgar salts, which are quasi one-dimensional. And then there's the fullerenes, based on the C60 molecules. And then there's ones which are generally two-dimensional, and they're based on this BEDT-TTF molecule. This is basically what the molecule looks like, where these are sulfur atoms. And you can also substitute selenium for sulfur. Now, basically, these materials have layers of these molecules separated by anions. Now, if you just had this molecule, you would have an insulator. But because of the chemistry, you combine two of these molecules with one anion, like a triiodide or something else, and that basically leads to electron transfer to the anion, so you generally end up with half a hole on each one of these molecules. So that's the basic chemistry, and that's basically, in a sense, what fixes the filling. Now, these letters, alpha, beta, kappa, theta, beta double prime, they lead to a whole zoology of things. And basically what they refer to is the way these molecules stack within a layer. And so I'll show you an example in a second of a kind of a stacking. But that's very important to understand that these are different. And I'm going to talk about the kappas, but also the ideas I'm talking about are relevant to the betas, but they're not relevant, I don't think, to the alpha, and certainly not to the thetas. Generally, these, I think, are at half filling. These are at quarter filling, so they're quite different. Now, in terms of the real materials, these are grown electrochemically. Right. Yes, sure.
So you're saying the alpha and theta are quarter filling?
Oh, that's my claim. That's sort of a subject for a whole other talk. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are they less correlated?
No, I still think they're correlated, and I think their charge ordering comes into play. Yeah, yeah. That's what actually we've been doing, working on more recently, yeah. So basically these are grown electrochemically. There's whole groups of people in chemistry departments who just basically they just change the chemistry and make different materials. But basically you produce these little crystals and they're very pure. I'll show you why we know that in a second. And then this is a typical size of a crystal, okay, which is wide up here for measurement. So they're quite small, they're very thin. That's in the plane it would be like 0.1 millimeters or something. So the bad news for that is that the chances of doing neutron scattering or synchrotron, ARPIS or something is pretty small, okay? Unless someone clever person comes up with a way to find better crystals. So this is roughly what, now this is not kappa, this is alpha, but in terms of what make the basic point. So what happens here, this is one way to look at it, is you have these large molecules here. Now, and then here's the anion. So you've got a layer of the, and this will be conducting within this layer, that's conducting, because you get very good molecular overlap in this direction. You get a nice band that way. But these anion layers are insulating. So you have an insulator, if you like, conductor, insulator, conductor. Okay, and so what we're going to do is just focus on a single layer. So they're very two-dimensional, and you can see that in the anisotropy of the electronic properties. Now let me show you then a phase diagram of one of these materials. And this was, nicely mapped out in detail recently. And I think Stuart Brown might have talked about this last week for those who are here. Well, this is where you take a particular anion based on copper. And so this is temperature and this is pressure. And so what you see at ambient pressure is basically you've got an insulator and then at below about 25 Kelvin you get antiferromagnetic ordering. Now, as you apply pressure, you get a first order phase transition into a superconducting phase. And then up here, you've got a metallic phase. Now, what's particularly interesting is that here, there's a first order line here. And so there's a first order transition from a metal to a paramagnetic insulator. Okay, now I'll argue later that's a Mott-Hubbard insulator. But also, what's particularly relevant for this talk is there's a line here, which you can clearly see in an experiment, where there's a crossover from basically what I'll argue is a Fermi liquid to a bad metal. So schematically, I've got it up there just because we'll keep coming back to it. But there's two ways you can go through this phase diagram. One is you can just have this system and you apply pressure and you sweep through it. The other way is you change this anion. You just change the chemistry. And so if you put in a copper thiocyanate, you actually start here. So you don't actually see the Mott phase, and as you put on pressure, basically, you destroy the superconductivity. Now, chemists have just now made, a whole, range of materials, so you can more or less go all the way from there to there. Okay, no questions? Okay, so let's look then at what this... some of the details of how the transport properties look. So the first thing that you can see that you've got strong correlations is you look at this picture. So this is where you take this copper chloride material and you apply pressure. And so at ambient pressure, you've just got an insulator. This is resistivity versus temperature. Notice this is a logarithmic scale. That's 1, 10, 100 Kelvin. And then this is also logarithmic, so that's like 6 orders of magnitude of resistivity we're varying there. And so we've got an insulator there, but as we apply pressure, eventually this comes down, and then you get superconductivity. So you go into a metallic phase. But notice that this is non-monotonic. Okay, so it looks conventionally metallic. Now, several other things are important. Down here, this is T squared. You can measure check the power law. And at low temperatures, it is T squared, which is what you'd expect for a Fermi liquid. Now, the other thing is that up here, even though this is looking metallic, it's very high resistance. In particular, it's bigger than, if you like, the Mott limit. And so if you actually calculate a mean free path, assuming some sort of Boltzmann model, up here, the mean free path would be much less than a lattice constant. And so that's a puzzle to explain that.
Russ?
Yeah?
I discussed with an experimental user doing the transfer of energetics, and they claim that even in the regime where they see T squared behavior, if you extract KFL, it's still small.
No, I don't agree with that. We'll come, yeah.
Okay. Why should there be a problem?
Well, the concern of claiming that we have a family equation.
How small is it? One or
not small?
No, I'll come to that. I don't agree. I'll come to that. Yeah, there's not. Yeah, I'll come. Yeah. Maybe he's talking about the interlayer resistance.
No.
Okay. So here's another example. And this actually day was very important for me in terms of beginning to understand what was going on. So if you measure the optical conductivity as a function of frequency, so this is up to about 300 millielectron volts. Now, at low temperatures, so in this case below 25 Kelvin, so this is just looking at a material that is metallic. So we're sitting somewhere, like we're sitting somewhere here about. And we measure the optical conductivity. And what you see is you see a nice Drude peak at low frequencies, and then you see a broad feature here at high energies. But if you go to slightly higher temperatures, you come up here, the Drude peak completely disappears. Now, all these are phonons, by the way. That's not so relevant to what we're talking about. Okay. So one thing that this is telling you, well, it's telling you that there's this energy scale here, which is where you're seeing a significant crossover in change from what might be a Fermi liquid to a bad metal. But one thing that I probably won't come back to is the frequency dependence of this Drude form doesn't fit any simple Fermi liquid form. So it's not completely Fermi liquid, but it is certainly a Drude peak. Now here's the thermopower. This one was measured at...
You said measure T squared for some range of temperatures.
Yep.
Now, if you look at the comparable range of frequencies,
you're saying
the frequency dependence in
the
optical liquid is less from
a liquid
than the temperature.
Yeah, the problem, the frequency dependence, we're looking over a much broader energy range.
So if you suppose that you restrict yourself to the...
Oh, we don't have data that would correspond to T. Okay. I mean, T is only 30 Kelvin. It's really small, yeah.
So that's probably why.
Probably, but dynamical mean field theory doesn't describe the... I'll come back to that. It doesn't describe... Still can't describe the frequency dependence of that peak. Okay, so this is the thermopower. So this is measured within the layers in two different directions. Now, notice it's non-monotonic, and also that it's getting a maximum around about temperatures of order 50 Kelvin. Now, in a simple Fermi liquid, it should be, thermopower should be linear in temperature. So it's looking roughly linear in temperature at low temperatures. But there's two problems. One is the slope here is huge. It's much larger than what you'd expect, particularly in a simple metal. But also that the magnitude here, which is related, is very large. And particularly it's of order Boltzmann's constant divided by the electronic charge, which is what you'd get for a classical set of electrons. So it's somewhat suggestive of some sort of crossover from coherent quasi-particles to incoherent excitations. Now there are significant magnetic fluctuations. This is NMR data from Slichter's group at Illinois. So again, now we're going down here. So the first one, this is T1 times T. So in a simple metal, that should just be a constant. It should be flat. But what you see here is it goes down and then it comes up. Now the night shift is also not temperature independent. This is the night shift. Okay, it's going down. But be careful here on the scale is that it's not, the night shift isn't going to zero at low temperatures, okay? It's just in decreasing by a factor of two. So suggestive maybe of some sort of weak pseudo gap. Now the Kuringer ratio should be one for a simple metal, and it's like 0.1. That's the Kuringer ratio there. So that's suggesting the significant antiferromagnetic fluctuations. Now, there's a lot of evidence that you really do have a Fermi liquid at low temperatures. You can basically do measurements that you can't do on the cuprates. Now the reason for that is that two things. One is they're very clean crystals, and also because TC is low, it's only 10 Kelvin, you can destroy, and the upper critical field is low, so you can destroy the superconductivity with a magnetic field. So you turn on a magnetic field, destroy the superconductivity, and then you look at magnetic oscillations. Now, just to give you an idea, the fact that there really is a Fermi surface, there's a whole book written on the Fermi surfaces of these materials. It's quite a nice book by Woznitsa. So these are the kind of magnetic oscillations you see. And you can see the quality of the data. And so you can do a very detailed analysis of the oscillations, and you can and look at the temperature dependence and the magnetic field dependence of the amplitude of the oscillations, and also the angular dependence. And basically, everything can be explained if you have a 2D or a quasi-2D Fermi liquid at low temperatures. You can't go to higher temperatures because then you just destroy, the oscillations go away. Now what you extract from this, you get an effective mass for the quasi-particles. Now compared to a free electron mass, it's usually between 1 and 7. Now that doesn't tell you directly how strong the correlations are, because you need to know what the band mass is. Now that's debatable, okay? But the band mass estimates would suggest that the effective mass enhancement is anywhere from, say, 1 to 5 or something. Now, the other thing you can extract from these oscillations is you can extract the scattering time at low temperatures. So this is just the scattering time due to impurities, basically. Now, this comes out to be extremely small. Okay, in terms of a temperature scale, it's like something like, depending on the material and how clean it is, 0.1 to 2 Kelvin. So that also corresponds to a very long mean free path. So that's why, Anton, I don't think at low temperatures where you've got T squared, you'd have... Although maybe at 20 Kelvin, I can believe it, but at 1 Kelvin or whatever, it's a very clean system. Okay? The tau from the resistivity.
Yeah.
Not always completely, but within a factor of 10. Yeah, within a factor of 10. But yeah, that's a whole nother question of trying to relate those two. Okay. And you can actually map out the Fermi surface. It's a very clever technique. You don't need angular resolved photo emission. Now, Viktor Yakovenko is not here because he's the one who actually figured out to do this. I mean, this was like 15 years ago. So basically, I won't get into the detail, but basically what you do is you take the crystal and you stick a magnetic field this way, and you measure the interlayer resistance, and then you tilt the field, and then you rotate the field around like that. Now, what you expect from semi-classical transport theory is you'll get oscillations like this as a function of, well, this is basically a function of the angle at which you tilt the field. Now, and then you can basically, through a clever thing Viktor worked out, you can actually then map out the actual shape of the Fermi surface, and that's an example of that. So again, the fact that you can do all that and it all ties together tells you that at least at very low temperatures, you've got something that's a very good approximation to a Fermi liquid. Now, what about the superconductivity? Now, this is more controversial in terms of whether how unconventional it is. But there is significant evidence that you do have gapless excitations or nodes in the gap. If you look at the NMR relaxation rate in the superconducting state, it goes like T cubed, there's no Hebel slick to peak. Now, there's all these other measurements which are controversial. I mean, there's numerous measurements, different groups, different techniques, and they're often getting different results. Some people get power laws, some people get exponentially activated behavior.
Concerning the powers that tell you that supposedly you have these gapless lines of nodes, but I mean, I just recently been told or heard that you have people have fitted, in fact, I think Sigrist tried to do this, when you have multiple sheets of the Fermi surface, and you can get something that looks like power very over very, very broad temperatures,
right.
You don't have any.
Right.
Any nodes, and in fact, it turns out that to see the nodes, you have to go to some extremely low temperature. So most of the people see, he claims, is not really necessary.
Right.
How about this?
Well, yeah, there's an issue there, that, and often they're not going to incredibly low temperatures. Let me give you an example of the data that I think is the most convincing. But yeah, I think a lot of this is debatable, and that's why I put it controversial. But this is from Russ Giannetta's group at Illinois, and so they can measure the superfluid density versus temperature. Now, so they basically measure the London penetration depth. So this is 1 on the London penetration depth squared as a function of temperature. Now, here, the one problem with their technique is they can't measure the absolute value of the penetration depth at zero temperature. But they can estimate that, and depending on that estimate, they'll get different cases. But in all these cases, they fit this to basically 1 minus T to the 3 halves. And they also compare it, they don't have it on this graph, but another one do, an exponentially activated form would look like this. It's very different from this. So in this case, I'm sort of convinced. But then there's problems, because this T to the 3 on 2, that conventional nodes just won't give you that. So that's what the origin of that is pretty debatable. Okay, so that's all the experiment. Any more questions about that? Because now I want to go to how would we come up with a theory that might explain some of this.
What's the coherence length
in the superconducting state? Oh, okay. It's a few hundred angstroms from memory. I might have to check that for you, but yeah.
Just one question. On this crossover scale, zero, you define from the maximum of the resistivity versus T or the inflection point?
No, there's different ways of, yeah, I didn't do it from the maximum resistivity. I'll show you some data. This is one very clear way to do it, is you look at sound velocity as a function of temperature. But it's not the maximum resistivity, no.
How do you plot these lines from the transport data?
Oh, from the transport data, I don't plot it from the transport data. And I don't.
You don't,
and I don't think other people do either, generally. Yeah. You look at other signatures, yeah. So I'll come to this one with the sound velocity later, because that's pretty clear. So I think one way is the thermopower, the maximum in the thermopower, I think, is a good way. And that does tie in then with the dynamical mean to it. Okay, so if you look at a single layer, then what we're looking at here, each one of these represents one molecule. So that's one, we've got one organic molecule sitting there, another one sitting there, and then there's good molecular overlap between them. So an electron can hop this way. And then notice there's a dimer structure. Now that's where the kappa comes in. In kappa and beta, you have this dimer structure. In theta, beta, double prime, you don't have the dimer structure. Now, so within the dimer, you've got some hopping integral there, which is much bigger than the hopping between the neighboring sites. So as a first approximation, you can treat this exactly and then consider hopping to neighboring dimers. So if you do that, and Kino and Fukuyama were the first ones, I think, to do this, you can then sort of simplify the model. So each one of these circles now, or ellipses, represents a organic molecule, and so we're going to replace each dimer by one site represented by that circle. And so then it turns out that there's hopping from this dimer to that dimer, and then to this one and this one, but there's no hopping this way. And that's because this distance here is much bigger than this distance. So what then this looks like is an anisotropic triangular lattice, because basically we've got hopping this way and that way, which is the same, but along the horizontal it's different. Or you can think of it as a square lattice with hopping along just one diagonal. Now, you can also estimate the Coulomb repulsion. Now you want the Hubbard U, the Coulomb repulsion. It's not on a molecule, it's on the dimer. Now it turns out that if the U on a single molecule is large, then essentially the effective repulsion on a dimer is the bonding, antibonding splitting on the dimer. Now, because of this triangular structure, you've got significant magnetic frustration. If U is large and you've got spin exchange, then you're going to basically have frustration of spins.
One question?
Sure.
From the symmetry of the drawing, it looks like you should be able to hop vertically with the T1.
Maybe the drawing's not as well done. So, but yeah, in the reality, this distance here is quite a bit bigger than that distance. And when you actually do the quantum chemistry, it comes out that there's nothing basically that way. But yeah, sure. That.
How do the T1 and T2 compare?
Well, it varies. Anything from T1 will be anything from 0.1 to 1 times T2. So anything from 10 to 100%. And the different groups, when they do the quantum chemistry calculation, get different results. So. But they're that ballpark. So the point is that it's significant. And the numbers vary also for depending on which material you're in, but not a large amount. Yeah, Antoine.
How well are these hopping parameters known currently? Because if I understand correctly, they used to be only extended Hückel calculations.
Right.
And I've seen a couple of claims.
There's factors of two difference between the different Hückel calculations. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one where there's an opportunity.
So the band structure is very inaccurately known.
Yes, I think, and that's one of the things that might come out of all this is some of you guys will go and actually do it, or carefully, yeah. Yeah, I think that there's quite a bit being done, but that it a lot of it hasn't been pinned down. Yeah.
Some Japanese guy. I can retrieve.
I can get you the Although I don't know, this is a recent LDA. I don't know that one, so we'll have to talk about. Okay. Yeah, we'll have to talk about that one. Okay. So there's so this is what. As your zeroth order approximation of a strongly correlated model, this is what you'd end up with. You think of it as a square lattice, and you've got hopping T2 this way and then T1 that way. And then you have a Coulomb repulsion on each one. And then you have basically half filling, because you remember you had, you transferred one, for each one of these organic molecules, you took half an electron off. So if you've got two, you've got basically one hole per dimer. So one hole or one electron per site. Now, so what we want to do is try and understand what's the phase diagram of this model going to look like as we vary the parameters. Now we know if we're at half filling, and if U is huge, then we'll have an insulator. But the question is, what happens as U gets smaller? Well, if we have T1 equals naught, then we've basically just got a square lattice. And we know that at half filling, we always have a Mott Hubbard insulator, and we'll have any ferromagnetic ordering. Now, if T1 equals T2, then we'll have a triangular lattice. And so then what happens is that you have poor nesting of the Fermi surface, and for smaller U, you can go from an insulator to a metal. And then if T2 is zero, if there's no hopping here, you've just got basically decoupled chains. Okay, now you can summarize all this without actually doing any calculations. You can summarize the bottom part as follows. Okay, so this is at zero temperature. So if this is the Coulomb repulsion divided by T1 plus T2, and then this is T1 on T1 plus T2. So if we're at zero here, basically we've just got a square lattice. So we'll always have a Mott Hubbard insulator with Nail ordering. Over here we've got decoupled chains. Now in the middle we've got a triangular lattice. And so then we know that we'll have a metal here, and then up here, then we'll have this 120 degree spiral ordering that most people think now is the ordering for the lattice. Now, I've added in a few other things. Okay, what I won't go into today, but we did, at large U, you'll have a Heisenberg model on an anisotropic lattice. And so we did series expansions and spin wave theory. And basically the result of it is you see you'll have Nail order, and then you'll probably have some sort of dimer order with a spin gap, and then you'll have some sort of spiral ordering. And we couldn't really say what we would have up here, but some sort of probably quantum disordered phase. Now, what you might expect experimentally then, as you're going here, if this model can really describe the experiment, you'd expect that you go from the antiferromagnetic insulator to superconductivity to the metal. So you might expect that basically what pressure would do would drive you through here, which would suggest at this phase boundary you would see superconductivity. Yep.
Why don't you have superconductivity for very small values of U? The system would always be unstable.
Okay, but why don't you have superconductivity down here?
In the middle. A low U.
Oh, U? Because, and this is calculations bear this out, which I'll come to, because of that. What's happening here at this phase boundary, you've got an antiferromagnetic instability producing large antiferromagnetic fluctuations. And once you're over here, those fluctuations are so small they won't produce superconductivity. So, I mean, this picture is a hand-waving picture, which I came up with a number of years ago. But since then, there's been a lot of calculations done that basically bear out this picture. Okay, now we can debate how good some of these calculations are and how relevant they are. I mean, I think there's a whole opportunity to improve on all this. But basically, calculations have been done using quantum Monte Carlo, random phase approximation, fluctuation exchange approximation, and they basically give superconductivity at this phase boundary between the insulator and the metal. And these are some of the papers that deal with that. Now, one of the things that is interesting that comes out, and I think it's an open question, is what's the relationship between the magnetic ground state of the insulating phase and the symmetry of the Cooper pairs in the superconducting phase? Now, as in the cuprates, Nail pi pi order seems to be associated with D wave singlet superconductivity. But one thing that Votcher and Degotto found was, and this is just at the level of RPA, that when they're in the triangular phase, so when you've got triangular 120 degree ordering, they got this S wave triplet odd frequency channel. Now, no one else has seen that, so it may be an artifact of RPA, although I don't think people have systematically looked. Okay. Now, the problem with all of these calculations, from my point of view, is that they're really working with the wrong metallic phase. I mean, because they're not, mostly they're sort of effectively weak coupling perturbative calculations. And all the physics that is in the, that I'll come to in dynamical mean field theory, none of them have that in there. So they would, for example, all have, you know, small effective masses and so on. And so whether they're really, to me, it's, and also the other thing is that they don't, they won't have this phase diagram. I mean, they won't have the insulator, they won't have that first order line. That's the phase diagram they would put. They wouldn't have any of that. So they'd get this bit right. Well, and also they would probably not have this such a first order transition.
So usually you get something like this, right?
Yeah, usually it's, I mean, Doug Scalfino probably can help me here. So it's looking more, is that, Doug, is that fairer way to...
More like that within, I think, a simpler RPA, although what Alfie was picking up when he goes for the frequency one, I could argue you could disrupt that, but that's, our frequency guys, that's a long shot.
Yeah. But in terms of just the pi-pi ordering, that's a more closer picture, yeah.
That's kind of what would happen.
Yeah, so...
Doesn't go to the left, the superconductivity, like in some of the
fermions? Oh, you mean doesn't go in here?
Yeah.
I don't think people have looked at that system.
But the transition should be first order. The transition
between...
The argument system, what happens to the potential
allow to do some of the recent stuff that allows it to break up in stripes, allows you to move into that region, but that introduces another order. Okay. So I think the main point of, well, at least from my perspective, I mean, I think this is all valuable, but it's telling you something's going on there that's worth pursuing, but I think it's far from the final answer. Okay, so what I want to move on to then, what we did with dynamical mean field theory. So mainly what I wanted to understand was this crossover and whether dynamical mean field theory could describe that and produce something that's looking like the experimental result. So what we did as the first attempt, and certainly there's a need to go beyond that, was we didn't look at this anisotropic triangular lattice. What we did was we looked at the hypercubic lattice and put frustration into that. And so this is following very closely what Antoine and Gabby and others have done before. So basically, if you look at the spectral density in this model as a function of energy, the Fermi energy is right here. Now, here we've got U equals 4T1 star, where that's the hopping on the hypercubic lattice, and then there's a diagonal hopping, which is producing some frustration. So this would be the density of states if there was no correlations. Now what happens at low temperatures is you get a Hubbard band, a lower Hubbard band, upper Hubbard band, and then you see this Fermi liquid feature. And the important thing is that at a temperature which is much less than the Fermi energy, the low energy scale, this Fermi liquid feature disappears and you just end up with a lower Hubbard band and an upper Hubbard band. And so naturally, you've got this crossover scale. And so if you calculate the resistivity in this model, then, which this is very similar to what other people have done, is you see that the resistivity as a function of temperature, for small correlations, it's fairly smooth, but as you're getting towards the Mott transition, you do see this non-monotonic dependence. But the other thing that's important is what the scale is here. This is roughly the Mott limit here. So this is where the mean free path, if you can define such a thing, is smaller than the lattice parameter. And notice that the temperature just goes, it just goes smoothly through this. And one of the things I think why that's important is that goes against one of Emery and Kivelson's ideas that because you see things up here well above the Mott limit, they claimed that, and it went smoothly, they claimed it meant you had to have some sort of strange quasi-particles down there. But that here is a nice counterexample to that. You can have a nice Fermi liquid with T-squared dependence at low temperatures. And so if you calculate the optical connectivity, you again qualitatively see, just like what you're seeing in these organics, is that at low temperatures you see a nice Drude peak and you see this broad feature which is associated transitions between the Hubbard bands. But then at some low temperature of the order of T naught, basically this feature is going away. And it's because that Fermi liquid feature is going away. And then the thermal power, again, is qualitatively consistent with what people are seeing in these organics. So this is thermal power as a function of temperature, and the scale here is Boltzmann's constant divided by the electronic charge. If you had no interactions, you just have a straight line. And as you turn up the interactions, it becomes non-monotonic, but particularly for strong correlations, you see it's very non-monotonic, and particularly that here there's a significant dip. And again, this is happening at the order of T naught, T star, where you basically what I would call this line. And so that's one way to extract it, is from the thermal power. And also notice that the values are, the magnitude of the thermal power, again, is very big around here.
Yep. About this thermal power, I think you showed before the experiments which showed very anisotropic behavior of S.
Yep.
So how would one interpret that?
Yep. Yep. Okay. Well, this is all, you'll have a simple Fermi surface. What happens in the real material is, I said that in terms of the hopping, basically I had hopping this way and that way. Now, oh, thank you. So what'll happen then if we look at the Fermi surface, it'll look something like this. Now in reality, okay, actually, in reality, I've forgotten where, there's a slight difference, I think, between the hopping. The unit cell is slightly bigger. And so you have like a T1 here and a T1 prime here. So it introduces a dimerization. And so what happens is you've got a Bragg vector here that you have to fold things over. And so the real Fermi surface looks, not quite doing this the way I should. What does the real Fermi? Okay. So the real Fermi surface looks like this, and then you get these open sheets. Okay, and so you actually have electrons and holes in the real Fermi surface, and so that I think will produce. But that's where someone actually needs to do the dynamical mean field theory calculation, I think, with the real band structure. Okay. Now, just to show you then another example of how well dynamical mean field theory works. There's a group in Sherbrooke, and they measured the sound velocity in one of these materials, and they saw significant anomalies. So this is sound velocity versus temperature, and now these are different pressures. So what the first one is, they're sitting right here. Okay, and so they come down here in temperature, measure the sound velocity, and they see a very big anomaly, about 20%, which is very large. At the superconducting transition, the anomaly is less than 1%. And then as they turn up the pressure, so then they're moving over here, you see that the temperature at which the anomaly occurs is getting small, is getting larger, so the curve's up here, but also the feature is getting smaller. Okay? Now, earlier, that group had done some earlier experiments which weren't as clear, but we published our calculations of what we thought was going on here. And so what we argued was the phonon self-energy is going to be related to the electronic density-density correlation function, if you allow for electron-phonon coupling. And so we calculated that density-density correlation function at low frequencies with dynamical mean field theory. And this is what you see. So this is basically going to be the phonon self-energy as a function of temperature. Now, for small correlations, it's fairly flat. But as the correlations increase, you see a feature which is occurring, again, around where this T, the coherence temperature is. So I think that this has quite a natural explanation in terms of dynamical mean field theory, and that you really do have this crossover from the bad metal to the Fermi liquid. So let me end. I think there's a lot of opportunity. So these are the big questions I have about all this. I think theoretical questions. I think one is still, what's the origin of the superconductivity and how it's related to the nature of the magnetic ordering. Another thing that's very puzzling is the pressure and anion dependence. Although you can produce a Hubbard model and you can say, well, what's happening as I go this way is basically I'm reducing correlations. It's basically U on T is basically going down as I go that way. But the problem is, if you actually look at the parameters that people are getting from quantum chemistry calculations, it doesn't vary significantly. And the other thing that's not clear is, as I vary these anions, not a lot changes, particularly within the layer. So whether there's some sort of effect of interlayer coupling, I don't know. So that is really quite an open question. There's an incoherent-coherent crossover in interlayer transport. That's another issue. But then also, the thing that's a little strange for me, given the cuprates are so non-Fermi liquid and they're close to a Mott state, why when I'm so close to this Mott state, why is this so Fermi liquid? And the question of whether, how close do I have to go, given this is very 2D, to see something that's non-Fermi liquid. So I think there's a lot of opportunities for dynamical mean field theory. There's no calculations that, well, we had one calculation, actually when we did that phonon calculation, we did marry a simple tight binding calculation with DMFC, but that's the only one I know of that needs to be done, particularly taking into account effects like we talked about here. But also I think a nice calculation marrying LDA would be great. Then the whole role of extended DMFT and whether it can get the whole phase diagram. And then there's all these other materials, which I guess I hope later I'll get an opportunity to talk about, which people haven't looked, well, we've done some work, but in terms of hasn't been looked at much at all, particularly from the electronic structure point of view. Okay, so thank you. Well, the calculations give dx squared minus y squared. Now, there's a paper in PhysRev letter last year using thermal conductivity that claims it's dxy, and I don't agree with that interpretation of that experiment at all. And since then, I think a Japanese group did a calculation where somehow they then ended up getting dxy, motivated by that. But I guess my prejudice is, because of the similarity with the cuprates, with the pi-pi ordering, I would have thought it would be dx squared minus y squared. And that's what most of the calculations give, but that needs to be checked. Yep, Antoine.
Let me try to play the devil's
advocate. Sure, okay.
And there's been some other proposed explanations for that crossover from metal to a battery. One is the which is always a concern in all organic compounds, uh-huh. Some temperature, part of the molecule start vibrating, uh-huh. Rotating, or whatever. Uh-huh. And in the case of the BDTs, people are concerned about uh-huh. Vibration of the N groups.
Uh-huh.
So that's one concern.
Uh-huh.
The other thing is the NMR anomaly, and
uh-huh.
the sort of pseudogap scale,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Seem to be roughly in the same temperature range.
So uh-huh.
Some other people would say, uh-huh. Okay, this crossover has to do with speed fluctuations.
Uh-huh.
What do you have to say?
Sure. No, I think that's the very good question. I think the phonon one, I don't buy into it because it's all just sort of qualitative. There's no calculation in terms of the strength of the coupling or anything that can produce it. So yeah, for that reason, I don't buy into that. But there are also sorts of anion ordering and stuff that goes on at higher temperatures. It does confuse the issue a little bit. But still, you still tend to see broadly the same results. I think the spin fluctuation one, yeah, I think that's a more difficult one to answer. But I would hope that if you did extended DMFT, that you'd see how the two couple in together. But again, I think the thing to me that the DMFT does, is at least on a semi-quantitative basis, it can hang it all together. Whereas again, I don't think with the spin fluctuations, you can get such a low, pick your low energy and the large enhanced effective mass. But what do you want to have a go at that? I mean,
if I had to go at it, I think I'd rather go on to the matters and use density matrix renormalization.
Oh, no, sorry.
Put that on a two-leg, and maybe
uh-huh.
one could pull it off on 4 or 6 to try and see what's happening on a slightly larger system. Uh-huh. It looks like your system, but it has this
uh-huh.
one-directional
right. Oh, but my question is, with spin fluctuations, can you conceive of how you could get such large renormalization of effective masses and things like that?
Again, you know, people get,
uh-huh.
I think if you look at some of Kunz's uh-huh. calculations,
uh-huh.
you'll find that if they run
uh-huh.
very near the singularity,
uh-huh.
they can increase that coupling lambda and
uh-huh.
they can pick up, I don't know, a factor of
uh-huh.
Effective mass of maybe 2 or 3. But if you uh-huh. want to get 5 or 7, that's starting to...
Right. But they also have to fine-tune it, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing why I don't buy that. And this seemed to me that the DMFT, it seemed to be such a broad parameter range, you could sort of explain this. I'm always skeptical about stuff where you've got to sort of fine-tune the parameters. Because this is such a wide range of materials, you see it, yeah.
So, one thing that was pretty interesting in the sense that depending on what that temperature is,
uh-huh.
if you've got very low-frequency modes that are somehow slightly reorienting a part of that molecule, you're
supposed
to wreak havoc.
Uh-huh.
Immediately with your hopping,
uh-huh.
and even if it just almost freezes in different spots or starts to move in some way, isn't this known in some of the C60 stuff where there's a concern that the
molecules
right. and all sorts of stuff happens?
Yeah,
it's due to that type of behavior. And you're talking about 50 degrees,
though? Yeah. See, I think I could argue against that because I think that this is all stuff that's happening on the end of the molecule where all the action electronically is around these
yeah.
orbitals, where I think it's a bit different from C60. I mean, it is a good point, but C60, the electronic thing's delocalized over the whole orbital, over the whole molecule. So that would be my first pass an argument against that. But, yeah.
I have also a question about the story
uh-huh.
the ratio of U over T. I don't believe at all that
uh-huh.
this ratio is independent of pressure. That's really hard to conceive. These materials
uh-huh.
are very, very soft.
Uh-huh.
And as we apply pressure,
uh-huh.
there should definitely be a dramatic change of bandwidth.
Well, but there's
such... U is also changing, I agree, because...
But see, because you can see U is not the U on the single molecule, it's the U of the dimer. But if what I did was I took, there was one calculation, one measurement where they measured they did the X-ray scattering, the crystal structure here, and they did it here, and then they recalculated all the tight binding stuff, and not much changed.
Right, but
So
I mean, it's an experimental fact that the system goes from a very good insulator to a very good metal over 1 kilobar.
Right, yep.
There must be a reason to that.
Yep, I agree. Yep, and it's the correlations are changing. So I agree.
These calculations, estimates of you and of T and especially of you, are probably much too rudimentary.
Right? Yeah, well, that's where there's people, lots of opportunities for people here that fix that up, yeah.
Except how the crystal structure changes under pressure for a given compound is not really known, because people have not done X-ray.
Well, there's one, at least one, there's a French group that does do this, and they...
They do that, but they haven't done it for these compounds.
Yeah, no, they have. No, there's one paper, I can give you the reference, yeah. Yeah. So, but yeah, maybe you can go and talk to them, get them to do more, I mean...
I'd like to just ask, I might have missed this, on the scale of your T's in use, how does the TC, compare to what we have in Cooperates?
It's high. It's, if the T is small, so the T is, would be, and debatable how big it is again, but it won't be more than 100 millielectron volts. So what's T in cuprates? It's an electron volt or something?
Maybe 0.4.
Okay. Yeah. So they're high TC. I mean, if you want to call them that, yeah. So.
Is it higher than cuprates or not?
Well, again, it
depends.
Well, it depends what the. Okay, you want to. So. Okay, well, how big T is, okay, so you want to know KB TC on T, is that what you want to know? Well, but then are you going to take the non-renormalized Fermi energy or the... Non-renormalized, okay, so, well, let's do that. That's 10 Kelvin, so that's 1 millielectron volt, and that's going to be, well, it's debatable, but let's say 50 would be... No, 30 would be reasonable. Okay, but we could vary this by a factor of 3. Okay, so that's
0.03. Probably you can get a better estimate of whether it's high TC or low TC from the ratio of the coherent length to the lattice constant. That would during the strong coupling regime or the weak coupling.
Yep, that's another way to look at it, yeah.
I'm just saying it's kind of
And the lattice constant's about 10 angstroms.
Not that strong couple that.
Yeah, except the lattice constant's bigger than we're used to. That's the
But I think it isn't as in that sense as strongly coupled as the cuprate. But it is still quite strongly coupled, yeah. Okay. Okay. Okay.